Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Phileas Club, the show where we get people from around the world to tell you what they saw in the news from the past month. This is episode number 45 for March 2012. Hello everyone and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is of course the show where we get people from different parts of the world to tell you and us and discuss the news from the past month. So we'll get a different point of view on the news that you've heard about, and hopefully we'll know a little bit more about how other people think and be more tolerant and nice and get along. That's the dream. We're working it every month. My name is Patrick Beja. Your name, sir, is Paul Fox. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm quite well. Thank you for having me again, Patrick.
Can you nice remind the good listeners where you are from?
Originally from Florida, but I'm currently in Hong Kong. I've been living here for about 10 years now.
Excellent. So it's about 6 p.m. here in Paris. What's the time for you?
It is just after midnight here on Sunday morning, Sunday morning.
Excellent. So yes, you are quite far away, which is consistent with the fact that you are in Hong Kong. That was a trick question you passed. Randy, what's the time for you?
It is 9:15 a.m. on a Saturday morning here, so we're almost evenly spread out around the world.
I like that. You know, I'm a little bit neurotic, so I like that we're about a third around the world, each one of us. That works nicely. Randy Jordan, thank you for joining us again. It's been a while since you've been on the show, hasn't it?
It has been a while. I think I have been on the show since I moved to Southern California. I think it's been about a year.
Well, I'm very glad to have you back. It's nice to have you for this show, but it's also sort of too bad because it's one of those months where I don't feel there's been a huge amount of international news. I mean, we could talk about Syria again. There hasn't been enormous changes, I guess, in Syria. The situation is still the same. Assad is saying he's going to make things right, and then he doesn't, and then people get pissed off and ask for more peace and changes. And that's about what's been happening for the past few months. So I don't know that there's a lot of relevant stuff there. Anything jumps out at you guys in the, you know, international news scene that's worth discussing? Because honestly, I'm not sure there is much. I mean, there's Mali and Japanese cargoes being found 8 months later, which is a little bit mind blowing. Did you hear about that thing?
That is mind blowing. Run that down for the audience.
So after the tsunami, the Japanese. Well, they lost a few ships that were taken away by the tsunami, of course. And they actually couldn't find one of the ships. And it's been found 8 months later near the coast of Canada, I believe. And that's
amazing.
It's incredible that there's actually, you know, it's difficult to conceptualize, to understand the concept that the ocean is so large that for 8 months you're going to actually lose a ship.
Yeah, even our largest ships are needle in haystack sized compared to the Pacific Ocean.
And it's like, you know, you see the movies, you see the technology we have. You're thinking we could have like some sort of space race can that would see what's on the ocean and find the thing. But no, for 8 months, they couldn't. I mean, I'm guessing they weren't, you know, looking for it too hard. But where's my space race can?
It's fascinating to think of all the debris in the ocean and imagine that one piece of the debris is the size of a ship. It's just, you know, it's fascinating.
What it makes me think I should never ever go on a cruise ship or anything like that, because if it ever sinks and we manage to escape after, you know, incredible efforts and bravery, you're still lost in the middle of nowhere and no one's going to find you for, you know, months and months.
Right. If you get out of sight of land in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and you're in the ocean, you die. That's just the way it's been for human beings for 1,500 years.
It's 2012, man. It's unbelievable. I do not accept that.
I think part of the reason is because nobody was really looking for it, like you said, and there was so much debris and things that, you know, houses that were basically sucked back into the ocean that people weren't really sure. I still think that even today, over a year later, they're not really sure of everything that got lost and that got swept up into the ocean. I mean, there's just stuff that's going to be gone that, unless it was yours and you know for sure it got taken away, that it's just going to be rubble now floating around.
Yeah, sure. But, I mean, a cargo ship, it's not like it was a little, you know, tiny rowboat. It was a freaking... Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, so that's not... It got a little bit of news here, but not much. It's not like it's...
I think
it's
more amazing is the fact that it's still kind of somewhat seaworthy, that it didn't actually just sink outright after all that time, and it's just kind of floating along there,
I guess.
I wonder, one of the biggest international stories, at least from the U.S. perspective in March, was the sort of sudden awareness of Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda.
Sure, the Invisible Children video.
Yeah, was that a worldwide phenomenon?
It definitely did get a little bit of play here in France. I'm not sure if it was because of the internet's, like, you know, there's still in France, there's still like real news and then the internet news, and they're very much separated. Like in sometimes you'll have, you know, I don't know, like current affairs and political stuff and the economy, and then you'll have a special segment in the news going like, and now there's this thing on the internet that's kind of funny and wacky. And so, yeah, it did get a little bit of play, but not, it wasn't huge news. It was still a very interesting phenomenon, though. I'm wondering if you heard about it too, Paul, in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I think it's more like Randy said, it was news for a little bit, but it really came only across the internet channels. It didn't show up in sort of the mainstream news channels here. I think it did get a little bit of play once one of the guys apparently had a breakdown and was out in the street naked stuff. And then it became a little bit more spectacular.
Did it transition into the actual news for you guys, Randy?
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. When anything that gets, you know, over 80 million views on YouTube, and that's YouTube alone, there are other video services that are counting millions and millions of views of this thing. You know, the internet impact through things like YouTube is still very U.S. centric. You know, maybe 50 million of those views were from Americans, and they definitely then expect to go to CNN.com and see stories about it, and CNN provides. As far as old school media, made the papers, like Paul said, maybe just as much when the head of the group that made the video got arrested in San Diego. But
they did? Wait, we didn't hear about that.
Okay, so...
Maybe do a recap in case, you know, someone who's listening didn't actually see the video.
A recap of the video?
Well, no, the story. Okay. The video is 30 minutes long.
The story is about the consequences of the never-ending and ongoing humane struggles in Uganda. It's been going back for decades, where these very large armies under these brutal warlords clash. They capture children from villages and conscript them into their armies. They send around rape gangs, and it's incredibly difficult to find a solution for it. And one of the warlords who is both trying to find a solution and trying to dominate the scene is this Joseph Kony fellow. He's been around for a while. A guy named Jason Russell in San Diego, California, made this documentary video called Kony 2012. And by the way, there's a fantastic real feature film documentary called War Dance that I think everyone should see. I think it's actually streaming on Netflix streaming in the United States. And War Dance takes you deep into the Ugandan refugee problem. But Kony 2012, 30-minute long video, gets suddenly early March, gets lots and lots and lots of hits. And then, like, so I say...
The video itself is basically a very well-done documentary campaign to make Joseph Kony known and therefore apply public opinion pressure so that the U.S. and other countries forced to capture him, kind of.
Right, right. There's a simple question. Does this go on forever if we know exactly who the real criminals are? You know, like, would Gaddafi still be in power if he wasn't internationally known? And the answer is probably yes.
Right.
So, you have that, and it kind of worked. It definitely got a lot more exposure on Uganda.
Well, a huge amount of people, me included, now know who Kony is. Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't have, you know, a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
Just before you continue the story, I'm just wondering, I thought the video was really well done and it actually moved me quite a bit. I ended up giving a little bit of money, which might have been a mistake because I don't know if it was scammish or how, you know, good the financials of the organizations were. I just figured, you know, you can never know, so I gave a little bit. I'm wondering if you guys... were, you know, not if you gave money or not, or were you moved / convinced, or did you think it was a scam from the beginning?
I'll let Paul answer that.
Well, I kind of avoided it. I came across it after I read some statements from people like Will Wheaton and others who kind of were saying that they weren't sure about the motivations of the company. And there's this sort of back and forth debate. On the one hand, they're saying that it's good because it's raising awareness, and that's the point of the video and the video makers. And so if you're supporting them, you're supporting them in being able to get the message out, but it's not really doing anything to directly solve the problem. And so there's this kind of sort of counterpoint out there that says people need to do more, not just supporting the video makers, but, you know, calling their congressman or doing other stuff. And so I could see both sides of the argument, but I didn't really think enough of it to actually give money to the campaign, because I really just don't, you know, I really don't know. And then, of course, the thing that happened later kind of pushed me a little bit further away from the issue. Yeah.
Well,
what was your feeling, Randy?
The incident down later in the month, you have a guy named Jason Russell. He's sort of the filmmaker here, and he puts together a group called Invisible Children, and he wants to do something about this major problem in this large African country. He makes a really good video, puts it on the internet, and I'm sure did not expect this much response. I'm sure he wanted response. You know, I'm sure that he was really hoping to get some charitable efforts underway and get some attention. But the attention he got was enormous. And it's very, very difficult to be agile and expand an organization rapidly and deal with the sort of response he got. And it's also problematic when you have a world full of people who are trying to find out just exactly how crooked you are and try to find out a reason to, you know, go online and call you a bad guy and that sort of thing. So, of course, everything about him gets dug up. You know, if he has an unpaid parking ticket, then suddenly his little campaign is a huge problem, and he's a bad guy.
Yeah, and that's why I'm a little bit. I understand that the problem is no one is ever perfect. There's, you know, charities always have that incredible percentage of money that they get that is spent in administration for the charity. I saw numbers about Invisible Children, for example. But the thing is, he actually did something that worked. And of course, raising awareness is not directly going to impact the situation, but it's better than nothing. And it did work, and he was very talented in making a message, in crafting a message that would be effective. So, right. I mean, I'm not informed about him, so it's possible he's a complete crook. But
He made a big mistake, in my opinion, and that is where you get to kind of, I think you kind of hold that group accountable for something. The big mistake was when it blew up, he should have gone to an organization that could handle the response, like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and said, "Help! I'm in deep crap here, and I can't possibly deal with this." And and also other much more shadowy charitable organizations just rise up out of the ground trying to grab people's money because it's being thrown around, and it's a problem. And so I do blame the guy for not basically turning it over to bigger hands.
That's pretty minor as mistakes go, if that's his only fault.
Well, what it led to was he didn't eat and he didn't take care of himself physically for weeks and ended up going mad temporarily and running around the streets of San Diego naked. And,
yeah, that's not great. I'll give you that. But I mean, it's not like he decided, okay, I'm gonna mess this up. He actually had some sort of a nervous breakdown. It's right. Not like he had nefarious intent and thought, okay, I made this video. Now my next step is to run around naked in the streets. You know,
he absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I mean, I liken it to someone coming up with a great idea for a new law and writing it out as an attorney would, and this new law suddenly gets a tremendous amount of interest, and you're asked to go, you're asked to go convince the President of the United States to sign it. And I think that's a point where most of us would say, I'm going to put this in the hands of someone who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
and it's just, like you say, it's not like a crime. But an organization that was not at all prepared for this sort of response tried to handle it themselves, and they made some mistakes.
Okay. I guess we don't really need to spend too much more time on this. It's not like it was the major news of the month. It was just something that we all heard about. So should we go into local stories then?
Sure.
Nothing much? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to start, if you don't mind. Okay, silence means you don't mind. So basically what happened in France was mainly the presidential campaign is still going quite strong, obviously, because the election is in like 3 months now, three weeks. And something quite tragic happened in the middle of the month, about 2 weeks ago. There were a series of killings, I guess, but we only realized they were related when the last one happened. It was in the town of Toulouse in the south of the country, where a guy, at the time we didn't know who it was, went into a school and shot four people, three young children. And when that first happened, it was a Jewish school. And when it first happened, we really didn't know what was happening, why he did it, and what if it was a hate crime, terrorists, what it was. And the reason I'm mentioning this is that, of course, with the election, and if you've been listening to the show, you know that in France there's a sort of power play on the right with the far right. The far right having, I would say, between around 15% of the votes probably in the first turn. And Sarkozy, who's the, I guess you say, incumbent candidate, trying to play to that far right and trying to talk about themes that they are usually comfortable with. So when it first happened, a lot of people were saying, well, you know, you play with fire and that's what you get. You get extremists getting a screw loose and then they go and do stuff. And that's because you were not encouraging them. But in French, we say souffler sur les braises, which means fanning the flames, I guess.
Yes.
So that's what people in the. Of course, I should mention, of course, the first thing that everyone felt in the country was complete shock. It's not something that happens regularly in Europe, even. We couldn't understand what happened. We couldn't really. It's one of those unfathomable acts of cruelty and madness that just leaves you speechless and shocked, and you're just. You know, the guy actually went into the school and methodically shot children. Like, he grabbed them by the hair and shot them point blank. It was a terrifying event.
Yes.
So that happened, and then that politically it was a very difficult thing to handle because we're in the middle of a campaign, and it's the sort of situation that, at best, the candidates are okay. You know, they do okay with that situation. And if they botch it, it's terrible because there's no way to handle it tactfully and not sound like you're trying to take advantage of it. And if you don't talk about it, then you're going to be considered as, you know, insensitive, or you have to express yourself or condemn it, or you have to say something. Basically, it went... The campaign was "quote unquote" interrupted for a couple of days, obviously, and then the investigation started. We soon found out that the guy who did that was actually a Muslim fundamentalist. He was a French-born Afghan and Afghanistan trained. Well, I say trained. Maybe that's overstating it. He went there for a couple of weeks or so. You know, it was a short trip, but he was definitely into an Islamist movement. He was recruited, but then independent. He was acting, it seems, independently in France. He's just one guy who decided to do something for the terrorists, you know, Islamist cause. He was saying things like, right, forgot to mention. He actually killed a couple more people before that, military personnel who had been in Afghanistan, and another person before that yet. I'm not sure about that, the first victim. But he, for example, said to one of the victims, "You kill my brothers, I kill you." So from that point on, I think he released some of the videos and he called the press and was trying to make a big play out of it. He actually filmed his killings. And thankfully, I'm thanking the journalistic ethics and people's ethics, actually. We haven't seen these videos on any screen that I've mm-hmm. found, or they haven't been broadcasted at all. So they haven't played into his thing. Anyway, we found out that he was a Muslim fundamentalist, claiming to be part of Al-Qaeda, of course. Not really. We couldn't find any direct links to Al-Qaeda operatives or to a cell, a terrorist cell, organized terrorist cell. Bottom line, about a week or 10 days later, he was found. He got holed up in his apartment, and our elite police force surrounded the place and ended up in a siege that lasted 30-some hours. He wouldn't come out. Apparently, they tried not to kill him. In the end, after 30-some hours, they got in and he came out guns blazing, injured two or three cops, and they shot him in the head. So, yeah, he ended up dying. There was a little bit of controversy. Some people were asking why the police didn't use tear gas and stuff like that, which I guess is a valid question. I don't know the specifics of the operation, so maybe there was a reason why they couldn't have done that. There was a little bit of scandal with the father of the victim wanting to sue the country because they killed his son. I think no one is really taking these claims seriously, that the crime that his son did was so horrific that there's really no one to defend
him. That's interesting, too, because I read that story on, I think it was France 24.
Yeah.
And my first thought was, all right, if he's claiming that, you know, he has a right to sue France because they killed his son, does that mean that the victims' families have a right to sue him? Because he was basically saying that France was responsible, you know, in this case. And I think the counter argument could be made in a civil suit for the families against him, right?
Well, you know, I don't think anyone is taking this very seriously anyway. It's not like we're thinking, okay, what's the legal basis for him suing France or for the victims doing it? The reaction, again, was sort of very measured, thinking, okay, this is ridiculous. We're not going to even, you know, not acknowledge, but dignify this argument with a response. We're just going to say, okay, shut up, stay in your corner. This is too serious and too tragic to even... I guess we didn't respond as well as they did in Norway with that fantastic mm-hmm. reaction of the... I think it was the mayor of Oslo or maybe the president, I'm not sure. An official who said... Sorry? Who said, no, it was my fiancé is telling me, the king.
I'm so glad you have a producer.
In my ear, there was the quote, maybe, sweetie, you can tell me who said that quote. He said, we are going to punish the gunman. We're going to punish him with more tolerance, more kindness, and more understanding.
Mm.
What's his name? Stoltenberg, the prime minister. Thank you. And that was a very beautiful quote, and we didn't go that far. But we also didn't devolve into the controversy for TV ratings' sake that I imagine, maybe I'm wrong, but I imagine we could have seen in a country like the U.S. such case.
Okay, I'm supposed to argue against that. But
no, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I had one thought when they go in to get that guy, and any time that the authorities go to capture someone who wants to die in the process, and that is always, gosh, I hope they've got the right guy. Of course, a father doesn't think you've got the right guy. He thinks that his son is innocent.
In that case, he doesn't. It's completely. We know it's him. I mean, he confessed. Sure, he claimed it. Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's just one of those things. You know. In other cases, you know, like you say, especially in the United States, where law enforcement can be a bit more aggressive, you just hope they've got the right guy. That's all that really truly matters. I wasn't that impressed by the story in the United States. That story out of France didn't really get any play here. I'm kind of mystified as to why, because you know, when you talk about things like this, you can't help but reference the States. It's like the States is the crucible where these sorts of things happen, and you find out whether or not it was, you know, whether or not actions taken were right or not, and so on.
And it's kind of interesting too, because you've got the parallel of the incident in Afghanistan with Staff Sergeant Robert Bales going on,
right,
somewhat simultaneously, you know.
Uh-huh. Same, yeah, you know, yeah. That's probably the answer to my question, by the way. The story about, you know, multiple killings in Afghanistan by a crazy American soldier obliterated it for American audiences.
Yeah, so I guess.
Patrick, I wonder, is this being received in France, you know, by the public at large as a just basically a guy who was kind of nuts And so it's more of a just a criminal behavior, or are they trying to really tie it to a more of a terrorist slant?
Well, he definitely did it for terrorist with terrorist motivations. He was, you know, that's the basis of it. But I don't think anyone is thinking, for example, no one's reaction is we have to toughen terrorist anti-terrorist laws, for example. There's a little bit of a play on that by Sarkozy. Right after that happened, he said, I want to make regular visiting of internet terrorist websites a criminal offense, which is, I think, ridiculous. But
that is ridiculous. You know.
But the thing is, I think in his mind, he's saying, if we know that you're at risk and we know that you're going to visit terrorist sites where they show you how to build a bomb, then we ought to be able to stop you before you actually build the bomb. Which, sure, but it's too, you know, it's not going to be possible in practice, and it has other issues that it's not the right response, I believe. But in general, a lot of polls were conducted right after this happened, and people's main concern is still the economy. It's not like all of a sudden the you know, terrorism shot up to the first place in people's worries in about the election. Their main theme, I guess, to answer your question, Paul, it's the easiest way I can say it is, no, we don't suddenly start freaking out about terrorism. He was one guy claiming to be with Al-Qaeda, but he's probably a crazy person. We had a series of arrests of a radical Islamist group. I think 19 people were arrested shortly after the incident with the guy. But it didn't turn the country upside down. We're being quite... That's why I'm saying I think we're being quite reasonable and even-handed in dealing with this on the country's level. We're not freaking out and all of a sudden throwing everything up in the air and saying, you know, we're not reacting to one controversy. We're still dealing with it, I think, the way we should have, which is, this guy was crazy. It doesn't look like a general terrorist organization. Let's deal with him, and the best way we can... with terrorism, the goal is to make you, is to terrorize you, right? So it's not going to kill hundreds of people. It's not going to kill thousands of people, except for very short, very, you know, exceptional circumstances. The goal of a terrorist attack is to terrorize you. So the way you respond, you know, you win against a terrorist attack, is to not be terrorized. And I think we've done that. So
I want to stand and applaud right now.
Thank you. I'm bowing. I don't know if you can see, but yeah. So Randy told us he didn't really hear about it that much in the U.S. What about you, Paul? In Asia, did it? I'm guessing, you know, even in France, it was very big, but it doesn't feel to me like it would have international reach.
It didn't really show up in the papers here. I caught it on France 24 because it was. And I visit that site a couple times a week, so it was pretty much, you know, headline news, of course.
Sure.
On that site, but I didn't see it in the local newscasts come up.
I have a general Hong Kong question for Paul and the news. Yep. In the last 13 years, since the handing back over from the Commonwealth, has Hong Kong shifted away at all from being inundated with a lot of Commonwealth news and attachment to Great Britain?
Well, it's nah. I'd say it's shifted some. There's been a marginal drift towards mainland China, and in fact, one of the local stories I'm going to talk about deals with that that sort of fallout a little bit since the '97 handover. Mm-hmm. But still, when big things happen in the UK, because you still have a lot of families here, there are still a lot of British expats who are also Hong Kong citizens who live here, and you have a lot of local Chinese who have British citizenship, British passports, with family there. So it still does have a pretty big play. I mean, for example, the royal wedding was huge over here, And, you know, it's ironic because you've got a system in place that kind of, you know, a government that doesn't recognize the idea of monarchies and things like this. But at the same time, you have people who still love these kind of ideas because they still feel that, you know, colonial connection to some extent. But with the younger generations, it's starting to disappear.
By the way, I said 13 years because I can't do math. Or I'm still living in 2010. That may be the case.
All right, so let's move on from, I think we've, you know, talked enough about the Toulouse killings. let's move on to what happened in your side of the world, Paul.
Sure. Well, it's been a big month, and you know, it's an interesting year because Patrick, you mentioned that you're having your elections there. I'm sure Randy's inundated with, you know, all the Republican primary news, and I still keep up with that since I still, you know, have an opportunity to vote when elections come around, although I do vote as an absentee, so I'm not really sure if that counts or not. I've heard different stories about that. but China is also going through elections later this year. They're having a major shift in power, and there's been a lot of rumors about stuff going on, about sort of a little mini coups within the government. There was a big story that kind of got international news about this one person in the party named Bo Xilai, who was a prominent figure in the Chongqing district, and he was seen as sort of this reformer. And there was this incident where his lieutenant kind of went to the U.S. embassy and was seeking asylum with a bunch of secrets on this official Bo Xilai, and the U.S. embassy apparently turned him away for whatever reason, and so it led to this huge
scandal.
Because
they don't want to
get involved.
Yeah.
So there's this sense that there's this power shift going on, because you've got the current president of China, Hu Jintao, who's getting ready to step down, and he's tapped, of course, the next guy coming up through the party ranks. And I guess they're considered a little bit more traditionalists. And so there's this whole kind of mysterious power struggle. There's been rumors coming out through Twitter and through Sina Weibo, which is sort of the Chinese equivalent of Twitter.
I've heard they're shutting down the comments on Sina
Yeah, Weibo. They've shut things down a couple times a week this week because people have been saying things like they've seen troops in Beijing and you know, there are soldiers on the street, and nobody can confirm or deny a lot of this stuff. But the economy right now seems fairly stable, and I would think that if these things were going on, at least on a large scale, that you'd feel some economic ripples coming out of China. But so you've got that election going on. It's interesting that the world is just going through a series of elections this year. And Hong Kong had its own election late last week. We have a chief executive here in the region. It's sort of a self-governing region, and it has been since 1997. And it's supposed to remain that way for 50 years. They have a 50-year hands-off policy that they signed with the British for the negotiation of the return back to China. So far, China has been kind of honoring that, and they're supposed to be staying out of politics and political affairs, but of course, they've got what people would consider agents within the region who are pushing things. They've got newspapers here that, you know, are sort of favorites of China versus the more left-wing newspapers or the more liberal newspapers that are sort of anti-China here. And so we had our own little election. Now, I say an election, it kind of sounds like we have democracy here, but we don't. It's an election where only a group of about 1,000 or 1,200 individuals get to vote. So it's a little bit
it's
of an
the
oligarchy.
Party officials?
It's not really the party. It's selective members. You know, you've got some of the tycoons, people like Li Ka-shing and some of the others who are able to do so. It's a very elitist group. And so they get to pick the chief executive, who's basically like, you know, in if you were to compare it with the U.S. political system, he's like the president. Although power-wise, he's more like a governor, I would guess. We also have a legislative council, which is kind of like Congress. Now, people can vote for legislative council members. There are certain seats. There are so many seats that the public actually get to vote for. So they do have some electoral power, but not for the chief executive. And this is something that has a lot of Hong Kongers really disgruntled, that they don't have sort of universal suffrage yet. And this is something that Beijing has been saying, well, we'll give it to you eventually. But they keep pushing the date back as to when they'll do it. And so this year we had two people running, a gentleman named Henry Tang, who was sort of in the camp of the tycoons. He was the pick of all the sort of rich elite groups. And another gentleman named C.Y. Leung. Now, C.Y. Leung was not the favorite to win. Everybody thought Henry Tang was the shoe-in. He was going to be the guy because, you know, Hong Kong is a place that's all about business. It was sort of built on this laissez-faire policy that the government should not be involved in business, let business do what business will kind of an attitude. And that's why it's allowed, you know, so many tycoons to prosper here. So they would, of course, like to see those kind of, you know, commerce-friendly policies continue because it's good for their business. Of course, China doesn't necessarily see it that way. And so this gentleman, C.Y. Leung, is rumored to have ties to the Communist Party. Anyway, because of a series of scandals that have occurred over the past few months, the favored son, Henry Tang, who was supposed to win, didn't. Because he had one scandal after another that came to the surface. The biggest one being that he had an illegal basement in his house. Hong Kong has very strict housing restrictions.
Do we want to know about what was happening in the... Oh, it was just like actually an illegal basement that he didn't have a construction permit.
Yeah,
for?
Was. He didn't have the proper... He wasn't. It's bigger than you're supposed to be allowed to have. And, you know, it wasn't anything illicit or bad going on down there. He had a little wine cellar. He had like a big TV room.
Just
you know, but people aren't supposed to have that kind of a basement. They're not supposed to have what's called an illegal structure. And so that was found out, and it was a big, huge deal. And then later there was another story about how he has a mistress and maybe he has an illegitimate son out there. And so his reputation basically got smashed. It got sent through the ringer. Some people speculate that all of this was uncovered because of, you know, agents loyal to the Communist Party leaking these things to the news. I don't know if we'll ever know, at least within my lifetime, if this is true or not. But needless to say, the new chief executive is, in fact, C.Y. Leung, a person who is, you know, very much believed to have ties to Beijing, ties to the Communist Party. And it has a lot of people very nervous and very upset because he is a real unknown. The tycoons are not sure what kind of policies he's going to put forth. The people are not sure about him. And everybody said it's going to take a few years, as with any administration, for him to sort of clear things out. He's got to clear out some of the current administration. Right now, we're sort of in a lame duck session for the next few months. But once he does, it's going to be interesting to see who he puts in there and then what kind of policies shall come to follow. So some people have speculated that right before 97, when the British gave Hong Kong back to China, there was sort of a brain drain. You had a lot of tycoons, a lot of money. A lot of the intellectuals leave the region and go to places like Canada, the U.S., and the U.K. And some people think that that might happen now, too. But we're just going to have to wait and see.
Man, this is why I love Paul. What a perfect explanation, just with all the right details. It just makes me want to go find a book on all these events and read it.
Well, I'm certainly no expert. Interested in political science. I like following the stuff going on in the U.S. and I find the Republican primaries very, very fun to watch. And so this was equally fun
to
Republican
watch. Anything is fun to watch. Sorry.
Yeah,
that one's easy.
But I'm certainly not an expert in this field at all.
You know, I'm absolutely not an expert, and it's very nice to hear all of that because we haven't heard about this at all in France. I guess it's really Hong Kong specific. It's not even China, right?
It would be like, you know, the gubernatorial race, you know, the stuff that goes on in California. You might hear a little bit about it because, you know, if it's dealing with Schwarzenegger or something like that. But if it's just a normal politician, usually it's not going to make the international headlines. And I think it's the same case in Hong Kong. Even though Hong Kong is sort of an international city, the stuff that does happen here tends to be a little bit of a tempest in a teapot.
Right. Randy, did you guys hear about
No, I'm so fascinated. This is great stuff. There needs to be a blog that gives international readers a look into things like this around the world. I think that would be
interesting. You know, there's things like Global Voices Online. I don't know if they do that specifically.
But. Right, but I want a blog that's devoted to scandalous basements. You know, you know what I mean? Like, I only want to read stories like that. You know?
Yeah. The big thing about the basement, I know in the context of things like, you know, Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky, or what's going on with, what's his name, from in France, the Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
Strauss-Kahn, yeah.
Yeah. And
well, yeah, that was
in
also something.
Of stuff like yeah. this, it's like very minor, but one of the problems is that as a politician, this gentleman, Henry Tang, was pushing legislation telling other people that they could not have illegal structures. They could not, for example, build things if they had a roof. They couldn't build like a because they have flat roofs here in some of the village houses. So you can build like a little extension or put up a small glass development on top. And that's illegal. So he's out there pushing policies saying, you know, this is illegal. But then they find out he's actually doing illegal stuff. So it makes people really, really mad when they see this kind of double standard. But again, in the context of political scandals, it is really such a minor thing. But it ruined his campaign and it ruined his chance. And Hong Kong has gone a little bit more red, possibly, now as a result.
Interesting. This is the perfect point for me to bring up that my cousin Sybil Wendler made an fantastic documentary called Once Upon a Rooftop, and it's online. You can go look it up and watch it. It's about the lost people who live on rooftops in Hong Kong and are essentially not counted for anything, and how strange their lives are and how easily one can just be pushed off and eliminated. It's a beautiful little film. Again, it's called Once Upon a Rooftop.
Cool. Excellent. So what about the good old U.S. of A., Randy? What amusing news do you have for us?
It's hard to imagine a news story that's going to eclipse the Republican and then eventually the general election in the United States, at least from now until November, I'm sorry to say. And I kind of hope that nothing comes along that eclipses it, because that would be horrible news. This has been at the same time both the most interesting campaign in my lifetime and an incredibly boring one, because an incredibly boring candidate, Mitt Romney, has been destined to win. All he has to do is show up, keep his mouth shut, not have any scandals. There's no way that the opposition for him could possibly overcome him, not that particular opposition, at least. And so it's been a set outcome for a long time, and that causes people to go a little crazy. You know, the other half of the Republican Party that think they can do better than Mitt Romney have gone crazy, and it's been a different thing every day in the news. The big one, the big example of the crazy in March was the result of some stupid comments made by Rush Limbaugh on his radio show earlier
Rush
in the month.
Rush Limbaugh? No, that can't be right. He didn't make any stupid comments.
Yes, Rush Limbaugh decided to that he wasn't in the news enough, and he needed to up his villain status. He's commonly referred to as the de facto leader of the Republican Party. That's giving him a little too much credit, but you know, he is just a radio host, a host of his own radio show 5 days a week. He's extremely authoritative, if not powerful. It's hard to say that he wields power. Anyway, in a very, very small controversy before he got involved, a student from a university student went to a congressional committee hearing in Washington, D.C., and testified about the also sort of local to the United States issue of health care coverage for things like birth control medication. And Rush Limbaugh decided to call her some bad names, decided to put her down nationally, and did so in a fashion that got the kind of backlash, outcry that makes you wonder why he hasn't been, why he's still on the air, how he can find an audience.
What did he say exactly?
It's kind of funny. This young woman is testifying before Congress and speaking on behalf of another person, not herself, speaking on behalf of another person who uses birth control medication medicinally for a purpose other than direct birth control. He called her, the person testifying, a slut and basically likened the use of birth control by a college woman to prostitution, and suggested that if she's going to have so much sex that she should prove that by taking video of it and posting it for us to see, this sort of thing. You're saying wow as though you didn't hear the story. Please tell me you didn't hear the story.
No, I didn't.
Oh, good. I'm so glad because
I heard that something about Rush Limbaugh being in another scandal, not on the news, but on social networks and stuff like that, but didn't really look into it.
The news was about a lot of Rush Limbaugh's sponsors, the advertisers on his show, fleeing like rats from a sinking ship, and that was very interesting news. It was interesting to find out just who actually was financially supporting Rush Limbaugh before this. The original lists that people compile, boycott these sponsors, turned out to be quite wrong. There were a number of sponsors that people didn't even realize were sponsors, and that sort of thing. It really took on a life of its own. Rush Limbaugh felt he had to apologize multiple times. And you can see why if you're losing money.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say the apologies were very weightless. I like the term not apology, the not apology when someone comes along and says, I guess I should be considered sorry if you need me to be. that sort of thing.
Not apology. Very
not
good.
Not apology. And that's really the whole story, but it sat on top of this this very fascinating debate that had been spurred forward by the Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum on really the difference between parts of healthcare that only apply to women and the rest of healthcare. And I'm glad for it. I think it's a good thing that people who are way far to the right, way far to the left, are given the opportunity to talk all they can, because the results are we find out what they really think, and we get to have more open discussion about what's good for the people. In this case, the issue put more light on healthcare in the United States. You can never have too much focus on the ever evolving healthcare struggle in the United States. It's a country of 350 million people that doesn't have a meaningful healthcare system. And the month ended in the Supreme Court taking up arguments against the so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, and that is a really good thing. We're getting to see just what to make of these laws that were signed into law by the president 2 years ago this month.
Okay, I guess there isn't much to add about this. It's sort of. I guess my question would be, how did this advance? Because you said they had to talk about the healthcare issue and the, how do you call it? The pill.
And sure.
Did that move things forward? Did anything come out of it? Or was it just, Republicans are against, I don't want to say against birth control because that's a little bit exaggerating, but are pro-lifers and the Democrats are pro-choice and that's it, and that's what's always been, or did something change about that?
I think in the United States there was a minor shift of the allegiance for some people, mostly, you know, women who didn't realize that just how far away from their views and their needs certain candidates are. You know, the United States is so well inundated with media, though, that if you're an adult and you're female and you're not at all aware of how one party or the other, is going to act in power on your behalf, I'd say you are stranded and alone and without energy. Like, that is a really unusual thing. People are very well aware of what's going on in the United States. But the big news there was that Rush Limbaugh lost money, lost sponsors, and a few more people became more aware of just how different your two major parties in the United States can be.
Okay, seems to me like they're that's actually not a lot, but.
That's funny.
Maybe. Okay. I guess that's it for our general news. Again, not much. I mean, I think it's the first time in this show where we haven't had, you know, one major event that everyone was aware of throughout the world. So maybe I'm forgetting something. And I'm sure our lovely listeners will let us know on the social networks and all of that.
Yeah, they're really, I see what you mean. Like, for example, the most discussed news topic in the United States for the last 10 days has been a shooting that happened in late February. A young man in Florida was shot while walking home from the store, and he was unarmed, and there was not a lot of zero reason for the person who killed him. And so that's big news. You go to United States news sites and you're going to see that. But there are a lot of murders, and the fact that one of them is the biggest news of the week lets you know that there isn't anything catastrophic going on in the world.
I guess.
Well, one of the really big news stories, it's kind of, I guess, it just ended, but it actually showed up in local news over here, was the jackpot for the Mega Millions.
Right. We heard about that, too. Actually, we did hear about that.
So,
okay, I thought someone was going to talk more about it.
Sure, I will. I've just thrown away several dollars.
You participated.
Oh, absolutely. There's a lottery in the United States that is subscribed to by a large number of the states. There are states where you can't play this lottery, but many of them you can. California is one of them, and it's called Mega Millions. And like most lotteries, when there is not a jackpot winner, the amount designated for the jackpot is put into the subsequent drawing's jackpot. So the jackpot for this one had not been won for a couple of dozen consecutive drawings, and it skyrocketed up to over $500 million. And I was actually hoping that no one would win last night, just because I wanted to see the total jackpot surpass $1 billion.
So, wait a second. Did you win?
If I did, I would never tell you.
I'll never know. Never mind.
It would also be real awesome evidence of how committed I am to the Phileas Club. Yeah.
Indeed. Maybe you're just here to try and, you know, bury the lead and not let us know that you
actually
won.
That's right. There were winners last night. There have been two or three areas identified so far, not individuals. And the total was estimated to hit $640 million, which caused lines at every store and place where you can buy tickets. Probably the jackpot was probably more than that because of last minute purchases.
You know what? That's all super nice. But if you will allow me a little bit more, you know, easy philosophy, money doesn't make you happy, as evidenced by many, many TV shows you guys have in the U.S.
Yeah, that's true. But I was watching a news story, and they had one of the financial gurus, Susie Orman, come on, right, because they were talking about the jackpot. And she said something I kind of thought it was a little bit profound. She says, yes, money can't bring you happiness, but no money can certainly make you miserable.
Yes, so, that's right, true.
One of my favorite quotes is, money can't buy happiness, but poverty can't buy food.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's absolutely true. But what I was actually getting at was, there was a study made about the how much money will bring you how much happiness. And there's a very visible curve below that, you know, it keeps rising. The happiness, the correlation between money and happiness rises until about, I think it's something like $50,000 a year, something like that. And, you know, when you get more money until that threshold, you get more happiness. That's undeniable. You know, you need money to buy food, to buy comfort, to buy, you know, housing, and to pay your bills, and a little bit more for entertainment. But beyond that, the money, the curve became super flat, meaning that more money did not equate with more happiness. And I really strongly believe that. I don't think it's going to, you know, make you less happy necessarily, because you don't have to go crazy when you get the money and turn into some neurotic millionaire. But if you're earning, you know, if you're earning a living already, if you're at, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, and you're not happy, I don't think earning $5 million is going to make you magically happy. It's going to distract you and entertain you for a few months. It's not going to make you happy. If I think that you can be happy if you make the right choices, and if you decide to be happy, not because you're magically going to be happy all of a sudden, but because you're going to make the choices that will make your life a happier life to lead. And that has nothing to do with whether or not you win $400 million at the lottery. Now, I wouldn't say no to $400 million at the lottery, or even, you know, 4,000 bucks in the street. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, you know, it's true that it's not going to buy you happiness.
Yeah, a friend of mine said that if he was a sole winner of a massive jackpot like that, that he would have to give most of it to charity, because he simply can't believe that it's right for one person or one family to control that much wealth. And I really like that idea of saying, you know, I've got some struggles in my life, so I'm going to take a little bit of that money and fix those problems, and then the rest of it someone else can deal with.
I guess to take the opposite view, that's an easy thing to say. You always see what you would do with your means of living, you know? No one is ever going to say, oh, everyone has problems. And someone who earns 10 times what you earn could use a little bit more money. Someone who earns 10 times less, if you told them, you know, I'm going to give you the amount of money I win, I wouldn't know what to do with that amount of money. I'm sure you get used to the different standards of living, and you have the troubles that come with them. So,
I think you're right.
Maybe it's, you know, it's the good solution. Give away the money before you even get used to that standard of living. Possibly.
Right. You're right. Yeah. Take your standard of living up, you know, some.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
Take care of your problems, but don't expect the no problems to come along afterward.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Is that it?
I have a couple of really crazy stories.
Ah, go ahead.
It's the United States. We have to have crazy stories. The first, you know, when we were preparing for the show, I was looking around at what got onto the news and what was just bizarre, and I noticed that people were talking about this family of so-called psychics in Florida, of course, Florida, where the woman in particular, the leader of the psychics, her name is Rose Marks. She was indicted for 20 years of basically stealing people's money. And I thought to myself, well, that's what psychics do, right? How can you go and indict one and try to put them in jail or fine them? I mean, you'd have to go fine all the psychics. But this family was doing something really impressive, and it blows my mind that people fell for it. And that is, they would come along, they would prove their psychic powers, and then suggest that what you needed to do was give them cash of yours, which would remain yours, and they were going to go pray with a certain method that they had to do in secret. They were going to go pray on the physical money, and somehow then they would give it back to you and you would become wealthier. And of course they, you know, would just leave with the money. And I got, you know, I just think that's an amazing scam. That's the kind of scam that identifies not only the stupidest people in the world, but just the saddest. Like,
you know, I'm really sure there are at least a couple of people in the audience thinking, yes, that's worse, but you're giving your money to the lottery, which has probably about the same amount of chance of getting you money as that scam.
Absolutely, but
who was it? It was Churchill who said the lottery is the tax on the poor or something like that.
It's a tax on people who can't do math.
yeah, exactly.
but in this case, when the jackpot gets high enough, there are some good mathematical reasons for playing. If the odds against you are 200 million to 1,
I agree.
It pays out 400 million, you should play, or it's worth you know, playing a small amount, yeah, just to be in the game. I found this story of these psychics taking people's money because strange, because I haven't told you the punchline.
Okay.
They're accused of somehow stealing a total of $40 million.
Wow.
All right. And that's not too bad.
That is almost enough that I want to say they should get to keep it. Because, wow.
And with all that praying, they could start their own church, right? I mean,
right, yeah.
That's actually quite impressive. $40 million? How much money in cash did people give them?
Even if it was over...
Go ahead, take, you know, those 20 grand.
Right, if it was over 20 years, they managed to get $2 million a year out of people. That's just... you almost think it can't be right. That must be an exaggeration. But
was it all in Florida?
No, they were travelers, and they were.
Because you'd think after a while people would get the word out in certain areas or something. I don't know.
They were travelers. They were indicted in Florida. I'm always amused when a story like that one calls them gypsies. They were travelers.
Okay. All right. You said you had a couple. Do you have another one?
Oh, Batman. Batman showed up in the United States.
This past week,
a fellow was pulled over in an extremely expensive sports car. A couple of cops pulled him over, and they had their camera working in the, you know, facing forward from their car. So there's video online. You can go see Batman get pulled over. The reason they pulled him over is because in his extremely expensive sports car, he didn't have a proper license plate on the rear of the car. Instead, the license plate was the bat signal. And
did it light up? Or
I don't know, but you can imagine cops come across this all the time. They pull someone over for, you know, improper plates there, and they're walking up to the car thinking, this guy thinks he's Batman, and Batman got out of the car. And the video shows Batman get out of the car and walk around, and they have some chuckles, and he explains that he's an entertainer on his way to an event. This was just the start of his celebrity, though. I would say he is of as much or more interest today as previously. We're sort of talking while his interest is growing still, and it's just a
so.
Yes.
He's of interest. You're saying he's becoming famous. You mean he's going on late night talk shows and stuff like that?
I think that'll happen next week. Okay. I think we're days away from that.
Okay.
We're currently seeing in the news, you're right. It's a slow news month when you go to CNN.com and the full name of Batman is revealed.
Right.
I've got one news story coming out of China. I'll put the link in Skype so you guys can see it. But this is
it's not going to be one of the ones Turkey usually tells us, like, oh, there's this guy who stole something and got his hand cut. Ha ha ha! And we're like,
well, I don't know if it's kind of disgusting. That extreme. But this is a story, it caught my eye. This is coming from a place, a province in China called Dongyang, which I'm sure if Scott Johnson were here, he'd have no end of fun pronouncing that. But the article of the title of this article is "Urine-Soaked Virgin Boy Eggs Are a Springtime Taste Treat in China."
Okay.
That's already sort of attention-grabbing in and of itself. But basically, this is a delicacy that has started gaining some prominence. Every spring, the street vendors in the city get together and they sell these virgin boy eggs as a sort of unique snack.
A virgin boy eggs?
Well, it's basically eggs that they get basins of boys' urine, and they have to be virgin boys. So the boys' urine comes from primary school toilets in the area. And the eggs are then soaked and cooked in the urine. And this is sort of they say it's been like this for centuries. They say it's got a very unique scent that's unmistakable, and people, it attracts people's attention. Supposedly, it has some medicinal properties. It says if you eat these eggs, you won't have any pain in your waist, your legs, or your joints, and you'll have more energy when you work.
Nice. I could use less pain and more energy.
Yeah.
Right. You might actually even agree to consume such a thing if you hadn't been told what it was.
Well, apparently, weren't there like Greek philosophers who would drink their own urine every day because it was good for your health?
I don't know the answer to that question. I just know that coming up on Frenchspin.com, the Phileas Club 45-Virgin Boy Eggs.
That is a possibility. Although I quite like my space race can. Not sure. We'll see. And I guess on that wonderful story of cultural pluralism, we will get on our way to close the show. Before we do that, though, I want to ask Paul and Randy to let us know where we can find more of your antiques. I don't know if you're if you say that. Yeah, like your funny behavior.
You can find my antiques in my mother's attic, and you can find my antics.
Right, that's what I meant to say. Thank you.
That's fun. I like that. How about on Twitter? Twitter.com/RandyDeluxe for me.
That works. What about you, Paul?
And you can find me on Twitter.com/FoxLore. And if you're interested in Hong Kong films or Hollywood films playing in Hong Kong and my take and local co-host's take on those films, you can go over to KongCast.com and catch our podcast, East Screen, West Screen.
Excellent. That's KongCast.com.
Yeah.
For myself, it's, as usual, not Patrick on Twitter and everywhere else on the internet, or Patrick Beja. And that's going to be it for us. We will be back with another episode of the Phileas Club, hopefully with more international news, but happy international news, next month. And we'll see you then. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.